Habu. Habu. Habu.
The bow. Greetings, Habu.
Habu.
It's the bow.
The bow.
The legend of the bow.
Habu. Habu.
Oh, the face of bow!
Habu.
Martha, we've been looking for the lost moon of Poosh. I'm the doctor. I save people.
Jugglery news from the front.
The jungle green.
When are we going to have news from the back?
Well, that's just not as fun, is it?
I don't know.
How's the bow tonight?
The bow is above the dirt and feeling good. Feeling blessed. I'm just happy to be alive, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, me too. Yeah, me too. You know, things could be a lot worse. You know?
Of course.
I mean, I have
Trump as president. Well, wait a minute. Oh, that's not the right time. We've got to get back in the police box.
Get back in the police box. I'm all going to come traveling with a doctor. Hobbs?
Causation. Matt!
Yo!
The guy with the kind eyes.
That's right.
Goblins.
Here we go, gentlemen.
Okay, give me a countdown there, Habu.
Everybody all set to launch?
Let's launch.
You got 10 seconds.
10 seconds.
10 seconds to go live. 8 seconds.
Oh, no, where's my sonic screwdriver?
5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. We're live.
You know what they say? Geronimo!
Is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath Terra Firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, I'm Micah Hanks, and you've locked in once again. It is the Grillion Report. Your news from beyond the fringe. News from the front, and we keep you company every week. Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, right here, right now, via the wonders and the marvels of KGRARadio.com. Looking ahead, we're going to be looking at the past and instances where fiction authors had made eerily correct predictions about things yet to come. In some of these instances, it will make it rather difficult not to be able to acknowledge that sometimes when people tap into their creative tendencies and they look at that side of themselves, maybe they're looking a little further out than just inward. They may actually be foretelling things yet to come, but more on that in a moment. First, I must bid homage and say hello, sir, to my good friend here in the bunker, the Grailian Reverend himself, co-host of the program and producer extraordinaire, Matthew Oakley. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Glad to be here in the bunker once again.
Always glad to have you here. And all of you guys out there in Gradio Land who join us every week, quick shout out to everybody there in the chat room. Follow me online at Micah Hanks on Twitter. You can interact with us throughout the show there on Twitter. I know Grimestake and some of our good friends who follow the show like to do that. And, of course, back in Master Control, my good friend, the beau himself, our producer at KGRA Studios, Mr. Race Hobbs. How are you, Hobbo?
I'm wonderful. Blessed to be here. Thank you for helping us kick off another great week here on KGRA.
Yeah. I tell you, I get so giddy on Mondays, getting ready to go live and take this show out there to folks' ears and into their minds and hopefully their hearts with the information that we provide. So last night was a little busy for me because, of course, Matt and I got our afternoon thing going on. We did our Grailian X show for the weekend, and there were some inspired rants, I think, Matt.
There were.
And in fact, so much so that I want to touch on one of the things a little later in the show that we dealt with, because I've got a couple of addendas. We'll get into that a little later. It has to do with UFOs and one statistician's analysis of why there may be UFO sightings at an all-time high. It was so good that if you really want to hear a lot about it, Matt and I spent a lengthy segment over the weekend, but we are going to touch on it a little tonight because it is indeed newsworthy, and news is what we do.
We're not going to go Alex Jones on it, though, right?
Not Alex Jones.
Not that level of rant.
We won't go to that level of rant. But since it is news and newsworthy, well, we feature that on the program, you know, in that great tradition of
news from the front.
The other thing that was going on last night, in addition to Fate Radio, Vance Pollock had me on as a guest, and I said, well, you know, you're right here in the neighborhood. And he has, yes, he actually has jurisdiction to be able to come down into the bunker. And so I said, guess what, Vance? It would be okay, I think. You can come on down here and just be a part of the Graylian gang. Do your own show, but do it from here in Graylian Studios. And so that's what we did. And he brought up something interesting I'd never heard of. He was telling this strange story about this thing called a Santer. Have you ever heard of a Santer, Matt?
No.
A Santer. This was news for me, too. A Santer was some sort of a bizarre cat-like creature that was seen here in Asheville, North Carolina, back around maybe the turn of the last century. And nobody really seems to know exactly what a Santer was supposed to be, or why indeed a Santer was lurking around Asheville. But the thing that differentiated it from a wild cat, because this sounds an awful lot like just a typical wild cat report to me, the way that they described it, they said, you know, we had this animal, and it gave out a howl that sounded an awful lot like an infant crying or a woman shrieking. And I thought, sure, I mean, there are a lot of wild cats that actually make noises like that. But the weird differentiating thing was they said that this creature left paw prints that looked more like a bear than any kind of a cat, and the witnesses who saw it said it would get up on its hind legs and it would travel for short distances in that manner of locomotion, which is very unlike most cats that we would think of, or at least most cats that I would think of, as I struggle with the cabling here in the bunker. Gosh, it gets to be looking a little bit like electronic spaghetti in here at times with all the cables and things we have crawling around. Matt, deal with that for me, okay? Not really. You're okay.
Okay.
But, so I told Vance, I said, at first I'd never heard of this Santer creature, but the other thing, too, about that that's odd is that I had heard a story a few years ago from someone who, coming back from Marshall on a fishing trip, there were about six guys, two of them brothers, and this fellow had said that we saw something that looked like a great big cat come running down the bank right out in front of the car. But he says it gets out in front of the car, and then whatever this thing is stands up on its hind legs and looks at us for a few seconds, and we're all going, what in the world? He said, I mean, it seemed almost monkey-like, but he said the characteristics were much more like a cat. Big eyes, pronounced ears, a tail that seemed to kind of curl a little. He said, I mean, it looked cat-like, and then the thing, I mean, seconds went by, and then it dashes off down the bank and toward the river. So make of those kind of stories what you will, but I thought it was an interesting addenda to Vance's story of the Santer of Asheville. Weird stuff. If you haven't had a chance to check it out yet, do check out Fate Radio right here on KGRARadio.com. That's on Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern time, so good times. But what most people, of course, were doing last night, Matt, yes, they were tuning in to watch the Oscars. Did you get to watch the Oscars?
I watched a bit of it, yes.
Yeah. Well, I woke up this morning having not watched the Oscars, but awakening to a lot of controversy.
That's putting it mildly,
yeah.
I think.
Well, there's a new term that they're using out there. They're referring to this as, what is it? Envelope gate.
Yes.
Yeah, envelope gate. So there is there are a number of conspiracy theories about what happened last night. Apparently, as they were announcing the 2017 Best Picture, they announced it was La La Land, but then the entire, of course, interweb went crazy because, well, Moonlight was the true winner, right? They were wondering, did I get that right?
Yeah.
Right order, yes. Yeah. So, and then the producer of La La Land gets up and he actually holds up the paper and shows, saying that, yes, indeed, Moonlight was the true winner. But it was really kind of a bizarre couple of minutes there. Poor Warren Beatty. I mean, I saw
Faye Dunaway actually announced it. And you could, I think, from my perspective, having watched the video and everything, I think Faye Dunaway wasn't really looking at the card. And you know, Warren Beatty kind of had it there and was holding it to himself and not saying who the actual winner was. And Faye Dunaway was like, oh, come on, it's La La Land. And just goes for it, and she hardly even glanced at the thing, you know.
Well, see, that's the thing. A lot of people have been confused about this, and I saw on one of the news cycles this morning, they were interviewing the producer of the film, and you know, he was talking about how, you know, in Hollywood we're all really supportive of one another, and it's really like a big family, and so there were no hard feelings. But how does a mix-up like this occur? And Anonymous, you know, I'm sure we're going to talk about it a little bit this week on Middle Theory too,
because they've created this entire hashtag for it. I mean, it's gotten a little weird. Not out of hand weird, but definitely people are speculating, was this an inside job? Did they do this just for ratings? I mean, nothing drives ratings like controversy, and apparently there was a Huffington Post article that had asked the question, what would happen if you announced the wrong film? So, I don't know. I have my own questions about it. I don't think it was some sort of a conspiracy, but here's what people around the web are saying. Okay, now it was reported at Bustle.com that an explanation from the Academy could also explain some things. As Bustle's Leah Beck had written, there are two people who knew the winners before they were named, Brian Cullinan and Martha Ruiz from the accounting firm PwC. Cullinan told MarketWatch before the show that, quote, from a security perspective, we double up everything. That's why there's two of us. We have two briefcases that are identical. We have two entire sets of winning envelopes. Martha carries one of those briefcases. I carry the other. With two sets of awards, no wonder things got a little chaotic. But Envelope Gate, as it has now been dubbed, may require a more creative explanation, because if Twitter is good for anything, it's showcasing the best and the worst and the craziest and the most unbelievable conspiracy theories on the web. So here are some of them. Here's a tweet from Aaron Edwards. I don't care what anyone says. They stole Moonlight's moment. This is a conspiracy. Tupac is still alive. Yeah, that's hilarious. What do we got here? Watsky says, WTF, I'm not normally a conspiracy guy, but in a world where controversy equals ratings, any chance this was engineered? Also, congrats to Moonlight. Millennium on Twitter says, conspiracy theory. The wrong envelope was purposefully handed to the presenters to take over the headlines instead of Moonlight's success. Dodger said, once again, conspiracy theory. It was a tie between La La Land. But see, I'm not sure all these people are serious about these. They're saying conspiracy theory. I think they're just, you know, putting ideas out there. But anyway, Dodger's conspiracy theory was it was a tie between La La Land and Moonlight, so the Academy staged an experiment where they announced one and waited for the results. Let's see here. Jeremy Urloff, he says, Trump is part of the La La Land conspiracy, right? He must be. I think it was aliens, personally. I think it must have been the aliens.
You know, I've got to say, I've got to catch more of these Best Picture nominees. You know, I've caught La La Land, as we talked about, and that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. Just, I'd recommend it to everyone out there in the listening audience.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm still waiting, of course, to see The Arrival, which race you'd recommended, and I have not seen it yet, but I'm going to. I plan to. Yeah.
Very, very well done.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other weird conspiracy, though, going on out there has nothing to do with Envelope Gate as it relates to the Oscars. It has everything to do with Nicole Kidman's weird clap. Did you guys see this?
I mean,
the way she was clapping with her, I mean, her hands in this very strange, pained kind of position with her fingers protruding outward, and she was like only like allowing the palms to touch, like right where it connects with the wrist. It was very bizarre. Go online, look at the video. Just look for Nicole Kidman Oscars clap.
Yeah, it's weird. It's obviously the angle they're kind of shooting her at.
I don't know, man.
I mean, she's a very slender, tall woman.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's one thing to clap like this, but I mean, like, seriously, it was, man, it was really bizarre.
Like her hands were trying to escape her body.
Like, yeah.
What exactly is wrong with having an original clap?
Yeah.
Hey, that's a good question, yeah. Maybe
don't
shouldn't
discriminate, Micah.
I shouldn't be so critical of another person's clap. That's right. I've been known to do a little of the jazz hands myself. You know, people keep asking me, by the way. People,
critical clapper.
Yes, I'm a critical clapper. People keep asking me. They're like, Micah, have you watched this show on Netflix called The OA? Have you watched The OA? And if so, what do you think of it? Okay, I'm going to tell you right now. I'm going to let you know exactly what I think about The OA. Yes, I have watched it. I actually watched the entire series. I liked it up until about 3/4 of the way through. It gets a little dark, but not unmanageably so. And then finally, at the very end, I'm not going to give anything away, no spoilers, but I got to tell you, I think, like Minnie said, it ended far too abruptly. And there were moments, again, if you have watched it, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say jazz hands. And there are moments where, unfortunately, the show, I have to say, although I think they're trying to be artistic and everything with it, there are moments where it's almost unwatchable. Because it is so unintentionally funny, to me at least. Okay, I'm not trying to be overtly critical, and this has nothing to do with clapping, but you'll know what I'm talking about. And a lot of people love this show, and they think it's great, so I've gotten a lot of recommendations from people in the audience. But again, all of those recommendations, appreciated though they are, I have watched it. In my opinion, it was not my favorite show on Netflix. And furthermore, yeah, there were some moments of unintentional hilarity that ensued, at least for me. Yeah, But a lot of people get freaked out by it because it involves kind of a torture dungeon kind of thing and psychological experiments and stuff kind of like that. You know, almost a little in the vein of something like Stranger Things, another show that really I love. But who didn't like Stranger Things? Is there anybody out there that didn't like Stranger Things?
I loved it. I'm really anxious for Halloween to roll around for season two.
I want to see season two. I want to see several seasons of it, in fact. I hope it'll keep going. It's a really great imaginative show, and I hope that they can continue to move forward with the new seasons and do as well as they did with the last one. But anyway, as I mentioned, that psychological kind of horror, though, I think that that really freaks a lot of people out. And for me, I enjoy that far more than the grisly kind of gore, the body horror, and things like that. But I'll tell you what's freaking people out in the Philippines right now. Strange things are happening on the shores of the Philippines, where two massive carcasses have apparently washed up in separate locations, sparking questions over what exactly has been dredging them out of the sea. So a shredded monstrosity, they say, laced with blood, appeared on the Dinagat Islands province on Wednesday. And last week, locals in Agusan del Norte dragged a massive oarfish carcass out onto a beach, sparking speculation that the country's recent earthquakes could actually be to blame. Maybe that is the case. Now, the oarfish, of course, obviously having been identified, not so much of a mystery, right? But then there's this big, massive thing. And actually, in Fortiana, there is a name for such unidentifiable globulous creatures. Globulous race. That's one of those. Put that on the list of words we like, would you?
Yes. I've got it on the list. Thank globulous.
You. Yeah, globulous. You got to remember, race, he has that affinity for those weird little globulous words. But so this creature in this image, again, there's a term for these things. These things are called globsters in Fortiana. And this the creature, they said, had caused alarm because of its large 4.5-meter bulk. That's about 15 feet over here, the way that we measure things. Matt, you're, by the way, in charge of the Ministry of Measurements now.
Oh, okay.
The bulk was so obscured, they said, by what appeared to be shredded flesh that no one could figure out what it was. The whole thing was very reminiscent of a monstrosity that washed up on a New Zealand beach late last year, which turned out to be a bunch of gooseneck barnacles clinging to a large piece of driftwood. My guess would be this is probably the remains of something like a whale, maybe one of the ones that had indeed turned up out there having beached itself. I don't know. But maybe, or the likes of which, because we've heard about a lot of whale beachings down there in New Zealand. But yes, they say that this unidentified creature indeed a carcass. Some had said that they thought it might be something a little smaller than a whale. One had said, according to a aquaculture technologist, they said it might be a sea cow. They based that on the skin found near the shore, which they had believed to belong to the creature also. But a lot of claims of various different kinds of sea monsters have come along over the years, and the famous story of Trunco is one of these. Trunco was this large, white creature that allegedly had an elephant trunk, and it was seen wrestling out off the shore with a killer whale. And this was a famous story, and people would wonder what in the world was this large white creature. But in fact, probably what it was as the body of a whale or another creature breaks down and the sinew begins to separate from the bone, it can take on this kind of first of all, it has a sort of a bleached or whitish appearance, but also it has this appearance of being furry when in fact these are just the sinews and things on the decomposing corpse. And so at a distance, people had seen all kinds of things, and they had perceived that rather than probably a portion of the remains of a whale being consumed by killer whales, they thought it was actually a fight going on between an unidentified creature and a killer whale. So there have been instances in Fortiana where there have been claims of sea monsters that have resulted from this, you know, allegations of giant jellyfish-like creatures, and yes, as they call them, globsters. What exactly is the mystery of the globster? Well, in fact, it's probably no mystery at all. But, you know, many people up there on the Alaskan coast do maintain interest in mysteries, and it's the last thing that you would ever think that they would appropriate government funding for. But did you hear the one about the National Park Service commissioning research on tales of sea monsters, as well as little people, wild babies, unexplained lights, and yes, Bigfoot, to the tune of $149,927. Matt, what do you think about that?
I think that it's interesting that we're cutting so much spending from other government programs, and yet we still have this huge amount going to such a wonderful cause. It's not that huge. I was being sarcastic, but you know, it's interesting that we're still trying to research this stuff in a federal way, no matter how minuscule it is.
Well, people, see, that's the thing, is many would say, when have we ever put government funding behind weirdness like that? Well, actually, there have been plenty of times that taxpayer money have been put behind everything from psychic research, especially during the Cold War. We wanted to try and test this and see if this was anything that could be utilized. We suspected our enemies in Russia had been doing it, and therefore, here in the United States, we'd do it here too. But then you go further back, the U.S. Air Force, beginning in 1953, and again, I think lasting through about the end of 1968, Project Blue Book, and that was only one of many iterations of Air Force UFO investigative groups. So, I mean, there have been plenty of instances where unexplained phenomena have indeed been investigated by government. Many wouldn't think that it's still happening today. Many would argue that it's not something that should be done with taxpayer money. So let me give you the context under which, yes, the National Park Service is spending $149,927 researching Bigfoot, sea monsters, unexplained lights, and other paranormal activity. Now, Kowarwak Inc. is a nonprofit group that serves the people of Eskimo, Aleut, or American Indian descent in the Bering Strait region. That's right between Alaska and Russia up there. And it received a grant last year. The organization illustrates its project with a picture of a hairy man or a mythical Bigfoot-like creature. This reported by the freebeacon.com. But the group is not just interested in researching hairy man. Of course, there are a lot of different things. Some of the other phenomena that they describe as supernatural include, among others, little people and what they call wild babies. And yes, they said unexplained lights, but also they say animals that can change into other things. And apparently some regional variety, there is belief in a regional variety of quote-unquote invisible sea bird. That's a pretty weird one to me, an invisible sea bird.
Yeah, quite specific, too.
Invisible seabirds, yeah. Well, they're not going to be of any particular color or anything or plumage because you can't tell. You can't see they are invisible. So how do we know that the birds exist? Perhaps they are heard or something else. The organization says the research, though, is important to understanding how culture influences beliefs in the paranormal, and that is the purpose for the research. They say the objective here of this project is to document in a serious and meaningful way Bering Strait residents' knowledge about experiences with and belief about supernatural phenomena. We think that this information is important to understanding how people relate to their environment and that there are actually culturally specific understandings of these phenomena which have not been previously documented. Now, see, I'm always saying I wish that we could have a serious study of Bigfoot that would look at this from a culturally or sociologically oriented perspective. I guess you'd really still say that that's anthropology, but I mean, nonetheless, take a cultural anthropologist's hat, put that on, and let's go out there and let's understand the impact that belief in a creature like Bigfoot has. I've always said that is something I think that we need to do, and I'm, you know, lo and behold, very surprised to learn that this is something that the National Park Service is actually putting money behind. Now, apparently it announced its intention to award a $150,000 grant outside the normal competitive process to Kowarwak on the supernatural study back in March of last year. The grant announcement said that the study would also include animals with transformative powers, a variety of other non-human persons, landscape features with special powers, and other similar phenomena, largely presented within the folklore of the regional people. And they said also that their intention would be to document as fully as possible from archival and other sources what is known about traditional beliefs, knowledge, and experience regarding the supernatural. This research also includes focus groups with community members about their personal experience with the supernatural. So for those in the crypto community, if access to this sort of research is later made available publicly, one might hope that there would be perhaps new documentation about people who have said that they've had actual encounters with the unknown or the forces that are being discussed in this study. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. Almost any way that you look at it. And I'm really looking forward to learning more about this myself. One final addenda here. They say the grant serves the program, the program's broader goals of fostering a climate of mutual understanding as well as natural resource and cultural connections between indigenous people of Northwest Alaska and Northeast Russia. Congress directs about $650,000 annually to the National Park Service for the program. The budget supports ongoing natural and cultural resource research conducted by a diverse group of partners, including non-governmental organizations, academic institutions, tribal governments, and indigenous groups from the region. So that is that, and that's what we know. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. But interesting to know, indeed, that there is some funding from the National Park Service going into this kind of research. I think that's good, especially in the way that they're going about it. You know, you have to keep an open mind about some of this stuff. That's what I'm always concerned about, is that at some point we're going to think that we know so much about what's going on out there and believe that we have made up our minds based on the evidence in front of us and have come to conclusive determinations about what is and what is not, and something along the way may become lost. In the next segment, I want to talk a little bit about a famous physicist and what he says he believes is proof that ghosts do not exist. Again, I'm not ready to close the book on that subject just yet. And again, I think maybe there needs to be a good anthropological study of belief in specters, ghosts, spirits, and haunts from around the world at some point in the future. But again, keeping an open mind is a really important thing. And you know, if you ever check into, there's a program that is featured at Gaia.com. It's called Regina Meredith's Open Minds. She recently featured a guest on there. Now, this isn't so much a paranormal subject, but what she chose to discuss with Glenn Streeter was the idea that we exist in a society that is filled with poisons, okay, and that technology actively drains the what he calls voltage from our bodies, and that we also live in a world full of solutions to almost every problem we face. So, well, should we recognize that some people, you know, you hear about the people who claim that they are extremely sensitive to things like Wi-Fi, people who claim that electric fields disturb them and even keep them from being able to sleep at night. Well, Streeter discusses exercises, foods, and other kinds of things that might help learn to promote greater health and perhaps that can help with these kinds of issues. But they offer a lot of kind of programming that deals with everything from, as we just discussed, the everyday issues that certain individuals may face, to some more broad-minded theories and, of course, things that deal with the unexplained. I mean, another really popular show that they've been talking about lately and really pushing involves our very own Linda Moulton Howe, who is a host here on KGRA. And her program, Truth Hunter, is looking at answers in regard to the famous RAF Bentwaters UFO incident of 1980. No matter where you stand on UFOs, I got to say, I think that many would agree that really the Rendlesham case is still one of those not only great perennial favorite UFO reports, but also one that involved government entities. In fact, actually, you know, RAF Bentwaters also not only being famously associated with the Rendlesham case, but also another incident that had occurred back in the 1960s that came out of the Blue Book files. So there's a bit of a history there. You know, the joint U.S. Air Force and of course, you know, being stationed there at Bentwaters in the U.K. There are a lot of interesting complexities. Also, the time that Bentwaters occurred, that happened right around the same time as the Cash Landrum incident. So a lot of questions remain about that case. That was discussed recently on the Truth Hunter program. And you can find all of that over at Gaia.com. And if you head to Gaia.com/Graylian, that's Gaia.com/Graylian, that is where you can get all of the information about the shows that we recommend. And of course, from time to time here on the show, we like to recommend others that we really appreciate. Gaia.com/Graylian. Do check it out. Sponsors of this program, and they provide content which we know like-minded individuals like you will appreciate. So when we come back, I do want to talk about, first of all, what the physicist said about ghosts, and also the physicist who said it. We're going to get into a little bit more here after this. It is the Graylian Report. Stay with us. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. That's right. Like ghosts that lurk in the night, we occupy the dark heart of the hollow earth and do our best work in darkness so that you don't have to. Always glad to be here and be a part of the KGRA family and to have my family members here with me, Hubbo and Mr. Oakley. Yeah. What do you think about ghosts, Matt? Have we talked about that?
Well, I do think that probably my main point on ghosts would be that if you have them, then you have everything. Yeah?
There we go. I always appreciate Matt's opinions on things.
Yeah.
Brian Cox has an opinion on ghosts, which doesn't entirely source from lyrics to rock songs. I mean, that was so unpredictable that he would say that. Many people believe in ghosts despite the fact that scientific proof of their existence is tenuous at best. This is reported by MNN.com, not MSNBC, Matt, but MNN.com. Oh, come on. I didn't throw a pin at you at least. Look, he's all hurt. He's like crying over there.
I'm fine.
Oh, man. Anyway, they say, after all, science hasn't exactly disproven the existence of ghosts yet either, right? And see, that's the issue I have, too, is that Well, I don't know. See, a lot of people would say, at what point can you say that something doesn't exist? Because, I mean, couldn't you just go on arguing forever that, well, if we don't have proof that ghosts don't exist, then they might exist, right? It'd be one thing, though, if you're saying that, well, we don't have proof that ghosts don't exist, but we don't have proof that they do exist. Therefore, if we can neither prove nor disprove, then maybe. I mean, that's kind of where I stand on things. It'd be one thing if you were saying that about something ridiculous like dragons. I believe dragons could exist. You can't say that dragons don't exist, but dragons might exist, though. Right?
Well, I think we've all heard that age-old argument of the burden of proof lies on the accuser. But I think in instances like this, that's a tenuous argument at best. I mean, really, when we're coming up with theoretical stuff, science like this, it's good to explore. And it's always has been good to explore, so why not explore it?
Well, yeah, I agree. And there are, again, like we were talking about with the anthropological studies of cryptozoology, that are being appropriated by the National Park Service in Alaska. We also have the Kessler Parapsychological Unit there in Edinburgh, which does devote scientific funding and laboratory space to the scientific study of paranormal claims, which typically have to do with hauntings and psychic phenomena and things like that. So, and well, as we, again, in our last segment talked about, I mean, yes, and in the U.S. government, there's a bit of a history of interest in those kind of things, too. So what we see is that we see that there are people who say, well, if we have not proven, but yet there is anecdotal evidence, flimsy though that may be, the anecdotal evidence, nonetheless, people say that they have seen things, so maybe there's something worthy of study. Well, again, MNN.com reports here that after all, you know, science hasn't exactly disproven the existence of ghosts yet, right? Well, perhaps it has, they say. According to renowned theoretical physicist Brian Cox, science has essentially already built the ultimate ghost detector, which he said was, of all things, the Large Hadron Collider. And it has failed to detect anything that could explain ghosts. As he points out on The Infinite Monkey Cage on BBC Radio, Matt, I know you listen to that one every week.
Oh, absolutely.
There's simply no more room left for ghosts in the standard model of particle physics, he says. He says, if we want some sort of pattern that carries information about our living cells to persist, then we must specify precisely what medium carries that pattern and how it interacts with the matter particles out of which our bodies are made. We must, in other words, invent an extension to the standard model of particle physics that has escaped detection at the Large Hadron Collider. That's almost inconceivable at the energy scales typical to the particle interactions in our bodies. Now, the LHC, of course, is the most complex experimental facility ever built. The largest single machine in the world, in fact, and it's also a particle collider that smashes particles together at incredible speeds to reveal any tinier particles that might emerge from these collisions. And while the LHC can't be said to be definitively powerful enough to have detected every particle in the universe, it's certainly powerful enough to have penetrated to the fundamental levels that pertain to how our cells use energy. And so, again, coming back to some of Cox's statements, he says, I would say if there's some kind of substance that's driving our bodies, making our arms move and legs move, then it must interact with the particles out of which our bodies are made. So I presume he's talking about the soul or the spirit, right? And he further says, and seeing as we've made high precision measurements of the ways that particles interact, my assertion is that there can be no such thing as an energy source that's driving our bodies. So in Brian Cox's view, I'm putting this in layman's terms, we're talking about there is no physical mechanism that can account for the soul, according to Brian. Yeah. But what about outside the standard model? After all, the standard model has been shown to contain some glaring holes, and many physicists today acknowledge that it's an incomplete theory as currently constructed, incomplete at best. So Cox anticipates this rebuttal, and he says he admits that there are plenty of problems with the standard model, but firmly contends that ghosts don't fall within the known unknowns of the theory. In other words, the standard model explains enough of the universe to rule out an afterlife. But again, it seems to me that really what he's discussing is some sort of a tangible quantity that constitutes the soul that can be measurable within the standard model of physics. And I guess he's applying that again to the notion that a ghost is therefore the soul of an individual separated from a living body, which I've always said on the show, and yeah, it gets me in trouble, but how do you know that a ghost is representative of the soul separated from the body of a deceased person which lives on after their death? How do we know that's what a ghost is?
Hey, man, 21 grams. You lose 21 grams when you die.
That's actually kind of interesting. So, yeah. I mean, I wonder if that's indeed a reliable estimate. People, I've heard that for years.
Yeah.
Do you know if that's like a...
I've read about it in the past. I don't know that it's been completely validated, but I've seen a lot on it.
Yeah, I mean, and again, there have been people who've tried to say that that 21 gram loss is representative of the soul leaving the body, and hence there is a measurable weight difference between a person at the time of, well, prior to their death and then after their death. But, you know, again, even without going down that road, again, either of those assumptions, whether it's Brian Cox talking about something tangible within the body that could possibly exist apart from the body, again, I wonder if ghosts aren't something entirely different. And that's what got me interested in looking at claims of bilocation. And listen, that's no more easily explained within the standard model of physics. But what I would, and I'm not using that idea of what if a ghost is not what we have traditionally said they are to try and make an argument against the existence of the soul either. I am merely saying I wonder if ghosts are representative of what we call the soul, and if they are necessarily something that we have to equate with religion or anything like that. I mean, I've really wondered if what people say that they have seen when they walk into a room and they see an individual standing there, or they wake up at night, or they're walking down a hallway and someone passes them and then it turns out there's nobody there. I mean, are these experiences that they have really with what we would call the spirit of a deceased person? I've always wondered, why is that? Why does that stigma exist? Why is that stereotype so firmly implanted in our minds about what a ghost must be? We don't have any proof of that. And the physicists go to one far extreme saying that there's no proof of ghosts at all. And furthermore, that really there's nothing that can prove that there's a soul, as Brian Cox alludes to there. Whereas, again, the ghost hunters have operated forever and a day on this premise that, yeah, well, we've got to prove life after death. What if it's not about life after death? What if ghosts are something completely different? Think how many times throughout history we have observed phenomena, and we've been incorrect about what we thought we were looking at. And with the acclimation of better data and the accumulation of science that is applied toward understanding said unexplained phenomena, we find that we can explain it, but it is not what we long thought it was.
But at that point, wouldn't we be proving Cox's point, you know, that we don't have validation of ghosts, we don't have any proof? And I don't think that's a completely outlandish statement that Cox is making there.
He's relying on the evidence right now, which we have. Yeah. Which, I mean, if you're going to be scientific, which he is a scientist, how else are you expected to think? I mean, he's not wrong. He's not wrong. But I would say he is probably more right than a person who would consider ghosts to be exclusively, you know, some phenomena associated with what we call the human spirit or soul. And the reason I would say that is because he's saying there's no evidence of that. So I think that what the ghost hunter has to say is, if there is no evidence of that, then if we are to try and make a case for ghosts, maybe we need to think outside of that traditional framework which we are thinking. Maybe we can find some place where the traditional standard model of physics does actually meet with, rather than the expectations, what evidence would dictate this so-called phenomena of ghosts is. See, I've never seen a ghost. I've never seen one, but I know someone who has. I do know a lot of people who have seen ghosts. I have interviewed dozens of people over my life who have seen ghosts.
But how many times have both you and myself sat there with every gadget imaginable in some claimed haunted place? You know, I've never seen anything to really sway me that direction.
That's mildly entertaining, but, you know, again, back in the day, trying to contribute, to, you know, in that way, you know, people taking little electromagnetic field detection equipment, you know, and things like that. Again, I became a skeptic, and I broke from that. You know, okay, look, let's back up. When I was in my late teens and early 20s, like a lot of young people, I was going to school. I was studying psychology mostly at that time, and I really wanted to, I was actually thinking seriously about going more down the road of criminal psychology is what I was looking at as my major at the time. And then I ended up actually leaving school and going to work in radio, and I did that for several years. But at that time in my life, I was intrigued by reports of ghosts and things like that, and so I was open to that possibility. I had science teachers in college who I would bring my photographs to of things that people had shown me and said, you know, we think this is a ghost. And so I'd say, do you mind if I... I wouldn't take it to ghost experts. I would take this to biologists and physicists, and I would get their opinions on it. And actually,
as one would do if you actually want to know what it is.
Well, exactly. Now, the first people I would avoid would be the people who had some sort of a bias or preconception within the community of the so-called ghost hunters. So I would go to, you know, the scientists, the science teachers there at the university, And actually, even where I wasn't attending school throughout the region, I actually made some very good friends with university professors at App State and also out at Western Carolina and here at UNCA Asheville, because they were willing to, in an educative kind of way, spend time talking with me from a scientific perspective about a lot of these kind of mysteries. Interestingly, only one of them ever was a hardened skeptic, but he even at times had these moments where he would be surprisingly open-minded about things, and that's Daniel Caton, who I'm still friends with up at App State, the astronomer, great guy. Contributed a lot of science to the study of the Brown Mountain phenomenon over the years. But biologists, chemists, physicists over the years, you know, I've shown them photographs, we've talked about things, and at no point was there ever, you know, Mikey, you really need to give this kind of stuff up. They actually would often be very interested in things, although they would maybe be more skeptical than I was at that time. But you see, these kinds of interactions over time informed my own skepticism. I'm still a person today that asks questions and will be willing to entertain a possibility, but I try to approach it fundamentally from a scientific perspective in doing so. There are certain people I know who, you know, my certain detractors who I can never convince that that's really how I think. But, I mean, I'll tell you, I'll spell it out for you. It's very simple. I mean, I really am interested in mysteries, but I think you got to be scientific. So what Brian Cox is saying should be a message to people who just want to believe for the sake of believing. If you really just want to believe for the sake of believing, I mean, it's okay if that's what you want to believe, as long as your beliefs don't hurt anybody else. But what I say is, if you're someone who's interested in trying to understand the unexplained, and you're interested in trying to further the narrative and contribute in a meaningful way to the dialogue as it relates to science and discovery, you know, you cannot hang on to those sacred cows, and you have to be willing to change your mind over time, and from time to time even change your position on things. And when new evidence comes forward, you know, you don't have to pick fights with people, but you need to have the grace to be able to say sometimes, you know what, my opinions have changed. And you also need to be able to accept that when someone disagrees with you, that it's okay for someone to disagree with you too. Accept that with grace. Don't poke, don't prod, don't make fun, don't demean, don't impugn. If you want to have that dialogue, you've got to be able to do it, I think, in a reasonable, in a grown-up kind of way. And that involves, I mean, really, I think, a little compassion. You know, and that's one thing I like about Brian Cox, is he's never been one of these snarky types as far as scientists go. He's always been a person who has tried to contribute to the narrative in a meaningful way, but in a friendly way, not in a dismissive way. And I say this to the snarktics out there, the people who are of such a skeptical mind that they have to, you know, attack people and criticize and make fun of people. If you really want to bring people over to your argument, you can't attack and criticize. How are you ever going to get someone to listen to you if you're constantly berating and attacking others? You've got to be at least friendly and approachable enough in both your demeanor, I think, as a person, if you're a blogger, if you're a podcaster like me, or if you're a scientist who's, you know, giving lectures at communities, you know, colleges and things. You have to be both approachable in that sense, but also you need to be careful in the way that you present your information so that you don't disenfranchise people. If it's just about picking fights, that's one thing. With guys like Brian Cox, I see it's about education, and they carry themselves, and the way that they move about in the world shows that to me. You know, they're not dismissive, they're not ridiculers, they're not cruel, they're educators. And I think if we want to be able to get to the bottom of mysteries like this, it will require education, both on the part, I think, of those who may not be learned physicists like Brian Cox, and maybe to an extent also on part of the learned physicists who have to be open-minded enough to allow for possibilities if new information forthcoming changes everything that we thought we knew about certain aspects of the physical world. When we come back, I do want to talk about the UFO subject here for a moment to kind of recap something Matt and I were discussing over the weekend as it relates to UFOs and statistics about sightings. Have we seen an increase? We'll look at that on the other side of the break. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. Now, this has been reported in a number of outlets, But the Daily Mail, I think, had been one of the most recent ones to report on this. The National UFO Reporting Center, of course, which is based in Washington, our friend Peter Davenport, the head of that organization. It is a site dedicated to keeping track of UFO sightings from across the world. And data from the site has shown that people living in the UK, the US, and Australia are most likely to report seeing an alien spaceship, while countries such as Russia, China, and Greenland rarely catch a glimpse of extraterrestrial activity. Extraterrestrial, you hear that, Matt?
Extraterrestrials?
Yeah, because, of course, they must be aliens. An analysis of its data by statistician Sam Monford, a PhD student at George Mason University in Virginia, has revealed that while the number of overall sightings is on the rise, the number of flying saucers being spotted has actually fallen. Okay, here's what he says. One of the first recorded UFO sightings comes from Portland in 1905, of course, seeing UFOs before it was cool, where a buzzing sphere-shaped UFO descended from the clouds. Other shapes began cropping up later, with saucers dominating the scene until the 1990s when mysterious lights began to become popular. Mr. Monfort said that the sharp increase of UFO sightings coincides with the rise of the internet in the late 1980s. But see, here's the thing, though. UFO sightings are not at an all-time high by any means. What we are seeing in that statistic there is, as they correctly note, yes, toward the end of the 1980s and really throughout 1990 to the 2000 period, that decade, what happened was with the proliferation of the internet, with internet becoming available in more and more areas and in more people's homes, and the accumulation of UFO information on the World Wide Web, sightings were not increasing. What was happening is more people were getting engaged in the UFO discussion. More people were contributing everything from reports. And the reason I say more were contributing to the discussion rather than saying more people were reporting their sightings is because in likelihood, with the ease of access to UFO-related information and material, more people became aware of the idea of UFOs. It became more in the public consciousness. And even though it had certainly been that over the last decades, the decades that had preceded the 1990s and the boom of the internet, with people being able to log on to the web and go look at information, they could get access to information more quickly. They could submit reports more easily. They could do so anonymously. They wouldn't have to go through the traditional means and methods that have been supplied by civilian UFO organizations. And so, again, what I see is not a growth or a spike here in the number of UFO sightings, which has led to right now, and we are at this all-time high. If anything, between 2000 and 2010, the sightings begin to taper off significantly. They don't actually decrease. Sightings are still increasing, but you got to keep in mind that there's this great period of growth between 1990 and 2000, and then it starts to very much flatten out. We begin to plateau, I guess you could say, between 2000 and 2010. And again, what that seems to indicate to me is that there was a huge period of growth in UFO reporting, people who were engaging in the UFO debate, people who were going online, websites that were putting up information about this, and yes, the overall number of reports, and thanks to the online presence of organizations like the UFO Reporting Center there, National UFO Reporting Center. And so when we look at all this and we see the factors that are included, I mean, when people are going out there saying, well, UFO sightings are on the rise, that's completely incorrect. I mean, what it seems to show is that technology is influencing the way UFO sightings are reported and the way that people are gaining access to information about UFOs. As far as saucers being the big thing back in the day, even J. Allen Hynek talked about the fact that the designation that he used in the days of Project Blue Book and thereafter, and of course going on throughout the 1970s at the Center for UFO Studies, when he had referred to daylight discs, daylight disc was not a terminology that was explicitly in reference to saucer-shaped craft. And it was essentially a catch-all term that described a wide variety of different shapes and descriptions of objects, which is why if you go to MikeIanks.com/blog, you can see some articles that I've written. And if you scroll down, you'll see an article titled Toward a Better Ufology, Science and the Study of UAP. And in that article, I have actually put together my own list of, I think, a more simplified and a less specific category system for identifying varieties of UFOs that do not imply things like disc or saucer shapes at all. And furthermore, I have what I call a sort of a systematic check, a list of things to check to utilize as a sort of a check for falsehood so that a more scientific approach to studying UFOs can be undertaken. Not with the expectation that these are UFOs and that by being more scientific, we're going to prove, I'm sorry, that they're alien. I'm sorry. Even I get caught up doing that sometimes because there's this semantic debate over what we all know that UFO, when they use that term, they, you know, the UFO experts, they mean alien.
Them.
Them, yeah.
Yeah.
there's this other article. And again, if you want to really hear an inspired session on this subject, Matt and I get really into detail about it on the Greylian X podcast this weekend. And we break down this HuffPo article where, and again, the issue that I'd really taken with this is that this guy, it's titled UFOs Aren't Real. And he pretty much bases his entire argument on Eric Von Daniken, who I don't consider a ufologist by any means. I mean, the whole ancient alien stuff, you know, some people love that. Frankly, I don't really care. I'm not that interested in that. Never have been. But ufology and the actual study of unidentified flying objects, perhaps natural, perhaps of any number of different hypothetical origin, these are interesting things to me. And I don't consider Eric Von Daniken any of that. If you're going to try and marginalize the subject by associating it with Eric Von Daniken, to me, that is not ufology. You know, if we're talking about UFOs, you can leave all that aside. Let's talk about UFOs. The other point that the guy makes is, you know, aliens conducting rectal probes on the white male population of Alabama. You remember that?
Yeah, this is the part I got a kick out of while we were doing the X podcast.
Well, I mean, the issue that I had was with the writer of the HuffPo piece trying to say that only white male members of the population from Alabama. I mean, I know he was just trying to make a joke, but first of all, I can't think of any people from Alabama that come to mind immediately who have been abductees. And then furthermore, to try and marginalize it, we already know that if you, of course, want to really make this sound bad, associate it with white males. This is, we're really late on the break, so I don't want to go off on a tangent here. But again, right now in this political climate, people are using stereotypes and a lot of problematic issues that we see in culture and society, and they use those as things to try and marginalize the UFO subject. You know, and trying to say that it's just bumpkins out there, you know, uneducated white rednecks down here in the South, that in itself is a stereotype, which I, my entire life, have had to fight, that we Southerners are all just stupid, that none of us have any kind of education or proper upbringing or intelligence. You know, we don't dress well, we don't think well, we don't act, you know, in accordance with the standards of intelligence or elsewhere around the world. I mean, and I have critics who they really enjoy being able to drive home the point that, yes, and Micah is a Southerner.
Well, I'm starting to say, people like you and me, we just sip a Bud Light out of a champagne goblet is the common perception, I guess.
I guess so. So, but it's just so ridiculous. So anyway, I just wanted to address that because, again, when we're talking about, on one hand, UFOs don't exist, and the reason why is because, well, only idiots and bumpkins from the South see them. Recognize the stereotypes that are being employed there. Recognize, in fact, that at times that kind of language, yes, some people here in the sweet sunny South, we even think that's a little offensive. Further understand, too, though, that the statistics that we're talking about, where people are running around, every tabloid is jumping up and down talking about this, UFO sightings are on the rise. Well, I would say read the statistics a little better and try to understand what may actually cause that apparent spike that occurred. Yeah, I mean, Mr. Monfort himself actually even said that the UFO sighting spike seems to coincide with the rise of the internet in the late 1980s. So question, why are all the tabloids saying that UFO sightings are at an all-time high? Maybe it's the way that we are looking at the data, right? More in a moment. It is the Greylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Bringing in the second hour of this week's edition of the program. Welcome back. It is the Greylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, as we continue spinning cosmogirally through space and time. Here in just mere moments, I want to get to some listener emails and then, of course, this discussion about fiction authors who have seemingly predicted the future with what they've written. And this is something that, as you're going to hear, I think has happened an awful lot more than you may think. I've written articles about this in the past, and it's the kind of thing, it warrants the question, when is truth actually stranger than fiction? Or maybe I should say, as strange as fiction. More on that in a moment. Of course, if you enjoy this program and what you hear, I do want to remind you, we have now uploaded all of our archives to YouTube. That's right. All of the past episodes of the Graylian Report are available on YouTube, streaming with artwork complementing each episode. Many of you guys out there, of course, you subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play. But YouTube is another way that you can gain access to the programs, too. And if you really like the show and would like to contribute and subscribe, it's easy to do and fun. You get additional content for doing so and monthly specials. Head over to GraylianReport.com/X, as in the letter X. And that is going to get you access to the Graylian sign-up portal, where you can get additional content to the tune of the weekly additional edition we call Graylian X Podcast, and also the monthly Enigmas specials. They're the kind of things that are really atmospheric, fun to listen to, kick back, you know, have a bite to eat. And speaking of having a bite with the family, you know, it's wonderful when you can focus on enjoying your meal and not having to worry about going to the store and picking up all the different ingredients and getting all the different things that you need and then bringing it all home. No, it's wonderful when you can concentrate on what's most important, enjoying your time with your family. And with Blue Apron, you can have wonderful meals delivered directly to your home. And I guess I feel kind of fortunate right now, because as new sponsors of the Graylian Report, what I spent the last few days doing, in addition to show prep and getting everything ready for the show, was I placed my first order. And this week, it's going to be delivered here to the bunker. It was so easy to do. You go to blueapron.com, you select whether you want a two-person or a family plan. They have a wonderful list of meal items, and you select your preferences, whether you're a vegetarian or whatever else that you like, even the day that you have it delivered. And you got to keep in mind that Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, including folks like you and I. And they achieve it by supporting a more sustainable food system, which sets the highest standards for ingredients and building a community of home chefs. If you're worried about whether it can be delivered to where you live, Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental United States right now. And because they shipped the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're also helping cut back on food waste. So it's not only enjoyable, it's also responsible. You can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free, and that is with free shipping. All you got to do is go to blueapron.com/mynamemicah. That's blueapron.com/mynamemicah, M-I-C-A-H. You'll love how good it feels, how good it tastes. And of course, it's great to be able to create incredibly good home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/mynamemicah. Trust me, it's a better way to cook. We appreciate them helping the Graylians here in the bunker do more of what we do, because you guys, of course, mean the world to us, and we want to give you as much as we can. And that said, speaking of you guys out there, let's get to a few listener emails. Charles writes, "Dear Micah, I'm an avid listener and a fan of your show and its level-headed approach to ufology and its healthy skepticism. I've been recently reading about Mac Tawney's," and he notes what an untimely loss to this field. He wrote a great book called The Crypto-Terrestrials, which I recommend if you have not read that. But he asks, "Please, can I ask you to do a show on Mac Tawney's and crypto-terrestrial hypotheses? I'm wondering why no one is talking about this or looking at this seriously, because in my mind, this is the only hypothesis that I can get behind. I do not believe that the UFO knots are extraterrestrial, as in traveling from distant stars and galaxies." So he says, "I'm looking forward to your response. All the best from London, Charles." Yeah, again, you know, I had corresponded a good bit with Mac back in the day myself. He was a really nice person. And right around the time that he passed away, we had had a brief exchange. We never met. But when he passed away, his book was sent to me by the publisher, Patrick Weege. We just got another book in the bunker today from Patrick, in fact, one by our good friend Lyle Blackburn. But Mac was a really forward-thinking guy, and he was not somebody who just was interested in UFOs. He was somebody who I saw as being a guy who was interested in artificial intelligence and the implications of artificial intelligence. His blog was called Post-Human Blues, which, of course, talked about the idea that, you know, I mean, there will be a post-human era at some point, and the technologies of today will affect eventually who we are yet to become. So that would be a great thing. And in fact, the idea had been pitched to me, I should say, some time ago, that we might even do a situation, something along the lines of where we do a Mac Tawney's tribute with a kind of round table. You know, a lot of people liked him. I think he was one of those bright flames that was taken from us a little too soon. So thanks for that, Charles. Jimmy writes, "Micah, you mentioned this case recently. I believe it was on an episode of Graylian X. I thought I'd pass along an update on the case. And the case he refers to is, of course, the death of a young woman who we discussed this again on Graylian X, Matt. We talked about the Tara Grinstead disappearance. Tara Grinstead, of course, had disappeared, I think, 12 years ago. And now officials, this is interesting. This is just a new development. I'm going to read right here from Macon.com. They say authorities have charged Ryan Alexander Duke with murder in the puzzling disappearance of Tara Grinstead, a high school history teacher and former beauty queen who went missing nearly 12 years ago. They say officials made the announcement at a Thursday news conference in the Irwin County Courthouse. Few details about the arrest or killing were discussed. Authorities said Duke was a student at Irwin County High School and graduated about 3 years before Grinstead went missing. A tip led authorities to Duke, said J.T. Ricketson, special agent in charge of the GBI office in Perry. The search efforts never ceased, he said, and Connie Grinstead said her family always believed her daughter's disappearance would be solved. We just didn't know when. So what we know now, and this was brought to our attention fairly recently by our good friend Steve Dave down a little further south. He had said you should look into the Tara Grinstead case. There was a podcast that recently was talking about her disappearance. And this is why I say that shows that look at these disappearances and they look at you know, programs, television, podcasts, radio shows, whatever, that spend time looking at unsolved murders and mysteries and crimes and things along these lines. They can contribute to people's interest in this subject. And thereby, sometimes people will hear about something, they might know something, they may have heard something, or they know somebody, and then there will be new leads, and this information will be forthcoming. That is a fascinating thing, but it's also very important because we have to understand that, you know, there are families associated with these disappearances, you know, or these unsolved crimes. I mean, there are human beings behind every story. There are people who want closure just like anyone else. And so I think the responsible discussion of these kind of things is a very important way that we can contribute to trying to help these crimes be concluded and, you know, be solved, and we finally do bring that kind of closure to the families. And so in this instance, it looks like indeed the accused killer of Tara Grinstead may have been found, Ryan Duke. So thank you for that update, by the way. I do appreciate that an awful lot, Jimmy in Georgia. Ben writes, "Hey, Mike, I hope you're doing well. I'm thinking about writing a book detailing all the events that happened in my house where I grew up. The trouble is I have no mentor, nobody who has the slightest idea what it takes to actually write a book, and that's me included. So sorry to be a pain, but I don't have anyone around me that I can ask for advice or who can tell me where to start. And so as an author of many books yourself, I would really appreciate any advice that you can kindly share with me." Well, Ben, you know, first thing I would say is really the best thing I think that you can do is you can try to brainstorm a number of ideas, come up with ideas, you know, put them down on paper, look at what you've written. You know, come up with a central thesis for what you want to write based on that. Try to think of your book almost like you think about a television show. Think about the way that you would structure a show. You know, you've got the introduction, and then there's a problem that appears. And then maybe you've got a climax. Now, the thing is that real life very seldom ever comes out, you know, comes about in such a way that everything is written out for you like that. So if you're writing about real life, you're going to have a harder time, you know, creating a climax and all these kind of things. That's just not usually how real life happens. But what I would say is, though, try to identify areas in your life that would be interesting. Maybe think about trying to, if you're going to write about your life, and see, I try to avoid that personally. I think that the number one trap that people fall into is, well, my life's interesting, and therefore I'm going to write about it and hope that this is a book that'll sell. And that's not to say that your life isn't interesting, but I think that, again, we all want to talk about our own personal experiences, but you know, again, there's so many people who just want to kind of write about my life as a such and such, or my life doing this or that. And in truth, I mean, it is a society where I think we really, I mean, there's still a lot of celebrity worship, hero worship, and this kind of thing, and people want to know the lives of celebrities, but I think you have to get to that point of celebrity before people want to know about your life. So if you want to be a writer who writes about your life, I don't think that it's something you shouldn't do. I think that the way, though, to go about it is to try and find ways to relate what has happened in your life, paranormal experiences or whatever else. Try to relate that to dialogue that may be something that more people can relate to, although your own experiences may be that also. And then finally, what I would just recommend doing is, you know, put together an outline of how you want to go about this. Put together a thesis at the very top of the page before you have the actual parts of the outline. Put together your thesis and, you know, state what is this book about? This, you know, this is what it's going to talk about, and what do I hope to achieve with writing this book? And, you know, when I wrote the Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting, I did that. I created a outline where I had everything written down that I wanted to talk about. And let me tell you, it was an extremely long outline. the book is pretty long too, and it took me a long time to write the book because I went down that outline and I stuck to the outline that I wrote. I stuck to the outline and I wrote everything. But the other thing that you have to do, if you're going to be a good writer, you have to find a good editor. Because unfortunately, so there are some people, there are, you know, novelists, Danielle Steele or, you know, Stephen King, some people who, they do seem to have a real gift, a real talent. But let me tell you, that talent you have to develop over time. You have to work with that talent. I don't think anybody is just born all of a sudden being an amazing writer or being an amazing anything. I mean, even people who seem to have a natural aptitude, Matt, we talked about this fairly recently. I think even people with a natural aptitude for things, they have to learn how to do that. And so my advice would be to practice, practice, practice. Try to orient your ideas in a way that people can relate to, and then create an outline and stick to it. And once you're done, whatever you've written, write a couple of chapters, share them with people, see what they think first. But whatever you've written, when you finish it, you take that to an editor. Do not self-publish without a editor having gone over your work and helped you make it better. Because if you do, I mean, that is what will define the difference between, for instance, someone who is just a self-published author and someone who really is a real author who knows what they're doing. Because any good author knows they need a good editor. So that's my advice for you, Ben. I hope that helps. And again, thanks to everybody who has written in this week with information or with questions, especially that Tara Grinstead development. And again, I'm fascinated when that kind of thing happens, when we actually have an addendum to a case, which, again, we haven't talked about on this public podcast, but Matt, we just talked about that the other day on the Graylian X show.
Yeah.
Well, getting back to a little of the news here, before we go into the discussion that's going to take up the or comprise the rest of the program, I do have this little item here. Have you ever been in a building and noticed that the building appears to hum? There are various things that may cause the building to hum. Yeah, I know. Exactly, man. I'm picking up a little bit of a hum tonight. In fact, it may be a little more than distracting at times. But this was reported in the Metro recently. They say noise reduction work has taken place at this particular famous skyscraper. Okay. Beetham Tower in Manchester is an example of a building that has a reputation for what they call howling or humming every time the wind picks up. And in 2007, 2008, and 2010, there was noise reduction work that took place there. But it's still known for what some call a famous hum that it produces. So they say the problem has grown to such an extent that a team of experts has been researching the cause of a whistling noise that this building seems to make in a bid to try and provide solutions on how to avoid it. And they say such problems have been solved in the past. Take City Spire in New York, which was driving people mad because of this high-pitched whining that it made, until developers removed every other slat from the building and found that this reduced the noise that it produced. So researchers at the Institute for Sound and Vibration Research at the University of Southampton have said that whistling buildings must be taken on their own merits, and that noises are typically attributed to angled slates, called loos, placed on the roof or over windows. That this is what tends to cause what sometimes is a deafening, shrill, whistling, screaming noise. The Institute told the Mail over the weekend that wind-induced noise in buildings can cause significant noise disturbance for both the occupants inside and the community outside. Tonal wind noise is normally associated with cavities or structural resonances of flexible components, and these resonances create the architectural equivalent of a musical instrument such as a flute or an Aeolian harp, which generate a tone at a particular wind speed and direction. But, you know, this isn't the only kind of a phenomenon in terms of the way that buildings can respond to things in nature. Matt, have you ever seen, for instance, footage of one of these bridges that when people start stomping along this bridge, it just shakes and vibrates? Matt, have you ever?
I have, yeah.
Yeah? It's fascinating where you can actually see a bridge. I mean, it's like undulating like a snake. So now, while the mystery of why buildings may hum has been explained by wind experts, again, you know, there are a lot of these other mystery sounds in nature that people don't know what the problem is. I've been fascinated with those for a long time. I mean, who knows? I think that most of the mystery booms can be pretty easily explained, but when it comes to something like this, it's kind of odd. Because, I mean, from time to time, you do have, like NASA talks about spherics, whistlers. They have all these different terms for strange noises that are heard in nature. And sometimes far from any buildings, way out in the country, you'll have these bizarre, almost they sound like an alarm that can be heard for miles and miles and miles. And we naturally presume that this emanates from the upper atmosphere, but is that really the case? Or could there be some sort of a phenomenon that has something more to do with the ground, you know, with geophysics or something like that? I don't know. But that does fascinate me. Who knows? Maybe with time we will understand the strange noises in nature. Maybe not exactly one of the most alluring mysteries as it relates to Fortiana, but you know, sometimes those little mysteries to me are the most important ones. And the ones that with science we can understand a little better. We may have to leave science at the door, though, here in a moment, because when we come back, we're going to look at where fiction has turned into fact. It is the Graylian Report.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Fade to Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. So I want to start off with a story, Matt, that you had actually brought to the table here. You had posted this on our show notes page earlier today, and the article asks the question, how the world can eat meat without killing animals? How does that happen, one man?
It's a trip. I kept seeing it pop up everywhere through my news feed, and I finally had to sit down and check it out. It's got a couple videos that goes along with it, but apparently, Supermeat, a startup company from Israel, has claimed that they discovered the cruelty-free direction and have an Indiegogo campaign that's now surpassed $100,000 in donations.
Interesting.
And the co-founder and head of the research department explains that, quote, our technology allows us to expand cells isolated from small tissue biopsy taken without hurting the animals. So in essence, that's the entire process. It's just expanding the cells actually taken from the animals.
But I mean, I guess that the long-term goal here, though, is they're talking about what I've always called petri meat. You may remember saying that. We're going to create actual meat in the laboratory. Well, not actual meat. That's it. But again, it's cruelty-free construction of something that's meat-like that can then be served. That is interesting. Now, the reason I bring that up, by the way, in conjunction with what we're talking about here, is because this is one of many things, Matt, that has been predicted over time. Time, as a matter of fact, in the truest sense, fits into the title of the book in which this particular prediction was made. Time is the Simplest Thing was the name. The author was Clifford Simak, and this was 1977. Yeah, they predicted artificially made meat in this book. And, you know, brief synopsis, you know, the characters in Simak's book mastered the ability essentially to make artificial meat, which was a product whose pros and cons are weighed heavily by Blaine, the protagonist, and Dalton, a businessman. And here's a quick little excerpt where Dalton says, there's a matter, for example, of this so-called butcher vegetable. You plant a row of seeds, and then later you go out and you dig up the plants as you would potatoes, but rather than potatoes, you have hunks of protein. And so, said Blaine, for the first time in their lives, millions of people are eating meat that they couldn't buy before, that your fine, brave system of conventions and ethics didn't allow them to earn enough to buy. But the farmers, Dalton yelled, and the meat market operators, not to mention the packing interests, and although the butcher vegetables, they referred to it in this, these potato-sized packets of protein that are grown in the ground, although they aren't exactly like the test tube burgers or, like I call them, the petri meats that you were describing there in the story map, you know, this anticipation of artificially made meat is essentially what's going on right now. See, a lot of people are kind of grossed out by it. But the idea is twofold here. First, we're talking about meat that is essentially ethically made. And we're not talking about having to, you know, claim this from the land or from, of course, livestock. But also, there are certain health considerations, too. Now, that could go both ways because some people would say, well, first, we have to take into consideration that if we're talking about health, how do we know something that essentially is a GMO, a genetically modified organism that's cooked up in the laboratory? How do we know that that's something that's going to be good for us if we're going to eat it? But on the other side of things, people would say that, well, because what we know about it and how it was created, in other words, this being something that was entirely created in the lab, we know all about its creation. And therefore, we also know that it's going to be good for us. Now, see, I would say the difference that I would have on that point is that we also know how the human body responds to traditional protein sources versus those which we are creating in the laboratory. And so that is something that I think I would be concerned about. Many scientists would say nothing to be worried about, but they always do. And later on down the road, is that going to end up being something we should have been concerned about all along? It could be. We don't know. So, I mean, while we're just at the genesis, I think, of the idea of really being, and we're certainly not to a point yet where the petri meat is, we've been talking about this on the show for years, you know?
Yeah, I'd forgotten the term you coined, the petri meat, forever ago. But, that was funny to hear that throwback.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's how long we've been talking about it. And it's not something you can go out and buy yet, but maybe it will be. Now, you know, again, looking at science, though, this is what fascinates me about what authors write, which later comes to pass. I had mentioned to you with my love for Sherlock Holmes, we were talking about the Sherlock Holmes blood test in the very first Sherlock Holmes novel, Study in Scarlet. In fact, in the very first sequence where Watson goes to meet Holmes before they actually become roommates, Holmes is very excitedly there at the hospital describing this new test he has for detecting blood and differentiating it from red paint or from rust spattered on clothing or something along those lines. Now, that was, I believe, 1888, but it wouldn't be until 1901 when Kentucky scientists actually developed a method using hydrogen peroxide and a couple of other substances to be able to catalyze a reaction that involved the hemoglobin in the actual content of the what would or would not be blood, as this test administered would help determine. And so I thought it was fascinating that Conan Doyle had written about that years before the actual chemical test was produced. But one of the maybe most interesting situations that involved a prediction that was made by a writer, which later seemed to have come to pass in real life, had to do with Edgar Allan Poe. We've talked about this on the show in the past because we've done a couple of tributes to Edgar Allan Poe, especially around Halloween and things over the years. And he had written only one book length or novel-length manuscript, really, I think. No. Maybe he had written others. I guess I'm thinking of Lovecraft had only written one novel-length story. But I think that, actually, the same might apply to Poe. Both of them were better known for their short fiction, I should say. But anyway, the story I'm talking about was the strange narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. The actual title, I guess, actually, was just the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. It was strange nonetheless. It's a very weird book, and it was written in a kind of way, weird, almost a symbological way in which the number of chapters like perfectly mirrored one another. The story has a lot of weird turns, and it goes in a lot of strange directions. But the gist of the story goes that, you know, at one point, a bunch of men are stranded at sea, and so the custom of the sea ensues, and they have to, in order to survive, they have to cannibalize one of the members of the survivors, and this was chosen to be a young man, the cabin boy, Richard Parker. And years later, in 1884... it turns out that there had been something remarkably similar that happened to what Poe had written about in the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. And on May 5th, 1974, Arthur Kessler had published a letter from a reader named Nigel Parker in the Sunday Times that described a striking coincidence. A little background, Kessler had wanted to try and do a contest to see who could send in the strangest story of a coincidence. This is the winner, okay? And this striking coincidence was between a scene in Poe's novel and an actual event that happened decades later. So in 1884, when the yacht Mignonette sank, four men were cast adrift, and after weeks without any food, they decided one of them should be sacrificed as food for the other three, just as in Poe's novel. The loser was a young cabin boy named Richard Parker, coincidentally the same name as Poe's fictional character. Parker's shipmates Tom Dudley and Edwin Stevens were later tried for murder in a precedent-setting common law trial, the renowned R. versus Dudley and Stevens. But that is maybe among the strangest instances that, well, I don't know. I can't say it's the strangest one. I got a real surprise coming up here in a minute. But a few others that have been mentioned over the years. Walter Gibson, the author who had written the famous pulp novels involving that character, the Shadow. Who knows?
Who knows? Only the Shadow knows.
Yeah, well, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men is the total thing. But there had been this anecdotal report that John Keel had made where he had said that years later, people who lived in Gibson's house would see a long-brimmed hat on a person who seemed to be wearing like a cloak that would walk through the house, and they said that it was like a ghost or an apparition that sort of resembled Gibson's own character. I thought that was kind of neat. There was the notorious William Dudley Pelley, who had lived right here in Asheville, and hence Vance Pollock of Fate Radio is really kind of renowned as sort of a Pelley historian. Pelley was kind of a ne'er-do-well. I mean, he supported Adolf Hitler. He had his own group of, you know, his own Silver Legion, the Silver Shirts that he called them, and he was eventually imprisoned based on sedition charges, I believe, by FDR after the Second World War, then was released on good behavior and also on the conditions that if he were to be released from his prison sentence, that he would not engage in any political discourse. And so for a time, Pelley actually involved himself entirely in spirituality. He even talked about UFOs a bit, and then eventually went back to his old ways and was engaged in very confrontational political speak. But Pelley had also been a writer of screenplays and things like this and certain fiction, and he had claimed that one night back in the 1920s, while having dinner with a psychic, that the psychic said, "There is someone in the ether around you that I can see. There is a woman." And she the psychic sitting across from Pelley, as the story goes, describes a woman to Pelley. And it blows his mind because it's not anyone he knew or some deceased person. He said it was a character in his novel that he was writing at the time that the psychic was describing to him. I always thought that was kind of neat, and I mentioned that in my book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. But maybe there's no better example, Matt, than Norman Mailer. Are you a Norman Mailer fan?
I am.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've read a couple of his books. I haven't read this one.
Barbary Shore, I think, was his second novel, and it was not a commercial success. By any means, but when he wrote the book, he had been staying in a boarding house in New York, and as the story goes, he said that as he began to write and flesh out the characters, that this Russian spy character just came out of nowhere, and he said that it was almost like so dominant a force in his creative mind that he had to incorporate it into the story, and so he did, and he wrote that into his eventual novel. And about the time that the novel was completed, lo and behold, there's a raid in the boarding house, in the building where he lives. And in an apartment above and to the left of him, there had been apparently a spy, a Russian spy living there, and they were actually ousted and then arrested. And he said it was so strange that, you know, as I'm writing that novel, I'd never intended this character to be a part of the story. And then I kind of give into the will of the, you know, the muses or whatever. I write this into my novel. And lo and behold, it turns out that, and see, he had based a lot of what he was writing in the novel on things that were actually happening in that building and the people around him at that time, people he knew. He didn't know that there was a Russian spy upstairs. It just so happened that he wrote it into his novel, and later one was revealed to have been living there.
Yeah, that's definitely strange. I mean, you know, he always used life experiences for content for his novels, but I was not aware of that one. I'm going to have to go pick up that book now.
Yeah. It's an interesting little bit of history, I think, that people can, you know, lend, or that you can lend to the argument that, well, certain people maybe do, in some strange capacity, write things that are almost, I mean, they border the precognitive. Sure, that could just be chance. And a mathematician would tell you, well, I mean, unlikely things, improbable things happen all the time. But there are a lot of instances like this as it relates, especially to science fiction. You know, one of my favorite science fiction authors of all time is Arthur C. Clarke. He had predicted, you know, the telecommunications satellite. Some would say that, of course, we were talking a couple of weeks ago about the monolith on Phobos,
yeah,
the Martian moon. Well, we had the monolith in 2001, and I think more than there being a prediction there, that people like Buzz Aldrin have employed terminology that was made popular by Arthur C. Clarke when they're talking about some of the strange features on that weird little potato-shaped moon. But Arthur C. Clarke, as far as predictions, I mean, I'm telling you, that guy, now he was a futurist, and part of Arthur C. Clarke's job was to be able to make predictions about what would be in the coming decades. But I want you to listen to this soundbite in which Arthur C. Clarke is asked about efficient communication in the future and how he envisioned that communication and technology would essentially interface in the future. Listen to this and tell me if his predictions about a future world as it relates to the internet, personal computers, all kinds of things. Listen carefully. Tell me if this doesn't border on being downright eerie.
I'm talking today with Arthur Clarke, the man responsible for communication satellites. Mr. Clarke, you've said not too long ago that in terms of communications, we're still in the semaphore and smoke stage. Would you put that in context, please?
Well, as far as the home is concerned, we have TV and radio and telephone. The telephone is the only way we can communicate outside yet. We get a lot of communication inwards through the radio and TV. But we're going to get devices which will enable us to send much more information to our friends. They'll be able to see us, we'll be able to see them, we'll be able to exchange pictorial information, graphical information, data, books, and so forth.
What would the ideal communications device be in your eyes?
Well, it would be a high-definition TV screen and a typewriter keyboard. And through this, you can exchange any type of information, send messages to your friends, which they can read. They can wait when they get up. They can see what messages come in the night. You can call in through this any information you want: airline flights, price of things at the supermarket, books you've always wanted to read, news. You'll tell the machine, "I'm interested in such and such items, sports, politics, or so forth." And the machine will hunt the main central library and bring all this to you selectively, just what you want, not all the junk which you have to get, you know, when you buy the 2 or 3 pounds of wood pulp, which is the daily newspaper. And incidentally, this is going to save whole forests for posterity, because the newspaper is on the way out, and we're not going to ship all this tons and tons of paper around when all we need is information.
Well, if we have face-to-face communications from our home, does this clue in with your slogan, commute? Don't commute, communicate?
Yes, and we are moving slowly, perhaps too slowly, towards this kind of world. And this is the way we're going to solve the traffic problem, ultimately, not by covering the world with concrete, but by getting rid of the traffic. And in the world of the future, travel will be for pleasure, not necessity.
And how will this sort of communication and travel for pleasure affect our social lives, do you think? In terms of, say, time zones.
Yeah. Well, it's going to affect our social lives in many ways, as much as the automobile has done in the past, in many ways negatively, as much as the telephone has done in the past. You mentioned time zones, which are of concern in a country like the United States already, where you telephone from one coast to the other and your friends may be asleep or they may wake you up in the middle of the night. But in the global village of the future, it'd be like living in one small town where at any time about a third of your friends are asleep, but you won't even know which third. So we may have to abolish time zones completely and all go on the common time, same time for everybody, which will cause all sorts of problems.
When you first came up with the concept of communication satellites, didn't many scientists think this was a pretty far out and unreasonable idea?
Well, it was far out. It was 36,000 kilometers out. But no, not at that time. This was 1945, and the V-2 rockets had arrived. And when my paper was published, the atomic bomb had been dropped. So at that time, people were prepared to accept almost anything. And I don't remember any negative criticisms. In fact, I don't remember any comments at all, to tell the truth. But there's certainly no feeling this was nonsense. And 10 years before, there would have been. But 1945, no.
What do you see ahead in terms of, really far ahead in terms of communications?
Well, the thing that really interests me isn't so much human communications, but communications with other intelligences elsewhere. This is the biggest unknown, of course, among the most exciting prospects. Will we ever pick up signals from space, radio signals or any other kind of signal? Everybody feels sure there must be all sorts of higher civilizations out there with tremendous technological capabilities. And we ought to be able to pick up their signals, even if they're not beamed at us. They must have tremendous powers to play with. And I hope that I live to see, you know, the first reception of a signal from outer space.
Of course, he didn't actually make it that far, but nonetheless, it's interesting, some of the things that he predicts right there. Obviously, he's talking about, you know, a high-definition computer screen with a television screen, as he refers to it, but with a computer keyboard in front of it. He says you'll be able to pick what sources, you know, sports or whatever else that you want to follow in the news. You'll be able to communicate with people. You'll send a message, and you can be able to go to sleep and then wake up the next day, and you'll be able to literally pick up the messages that you received overnight. He is anticipating everything from Facebook and Messenger to Skype, which was essentially featured in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
You know, he's anticipating. In fact, he had said that he thought that wristwatches would, like Dick Tracy, he had at one point said that he thought that wristwatches would replace or telephones. But really, I think what he was anticipating, and he actually goes on to say this, specifically that telephones will be portable in the future, and that means that, you know, you won't miss as many calls, but by the same token, you'll also have to account for why you missed calls if you don't pick up, because he said, and see, that's the thing. With a cell phone, I have to leave my cell phone in another room because there's not just phone calls coming to that device. I mean, again, that's why I call telephones cell phones, portable multifunction devices. They are devices, computers, that possess more technology on that little device than what sent us to the moon, and yet we, maybe not the power per se, you know, but they certainly have the technology. But then these little devices, I mean, they happen to be able to make phone calls and receive phone calls. There are so many more things that people use smartphones for, though, these days. And so, I mean, Arthur C. Clarke was fascinating to me because he was somebody who was on the forefront of technology, and he was looking ahead, and he was making educated guesses, hypotheses about what would be yet to come and what would emerge in the coming decades. And then he would write about that in his fiction. And yet, of course, no, we didn't make it to Jupiter in 2001, did we?
No, but the AI aspect as well. I mean, AI? You have all of that stuff. I loved reading 2001. I've not yet gotten around to, what is it? There's a whole series like 2061 and all that stuff. But I've read part of 2010.
Well, the book's much different from the film, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I mean, it goes much more in depth into a lot of aspects. When I first watched the film, I don't know why now. It is a weird film, but I don't know why I didn't understand it so well when I watched that film. And reading it gave me a much better perspective on exactly what artistically the film was trying to portray.
Yeah.
But I still love that film. I really do. Here's a couple that I know that you really appreciate, Matt. Okay, so Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of that one in you know, society today.
Yeah.
I mean, think about, you know, where we're taking, and actually, there had been a website that had talked about this. Let me see if I can find this link. I've got links all over the place here, and I'm trying to figure out which one I want to look at. But there had been a review of Huxley's Brave New World that had essentially said that he had predicted things about the future, and they were talking about, like, antidepressants, okay? And in other words, mood-altering medications that people would take. But what I see from Huxley right now, and what is really almost kind of weirding me out, is the way that in Brave New World, here, I think, yeah, okay, so Mashable had a listing of sci-fi novels that had predicted the future. They'd said Huxley's novel predicted the use of mood-enhancing medicine that keeps the citizens of London sane, not entirely unlike antidepressants, and the use of genetic engineering, which is not unlike the, you know, the Petri meat we were talking about.
Yeah.
But what I also see is a society that is encouraging essentially the breakdown of the family, promiscuity, and people are all being cooked up in laboratories. I mean, seriously, I mean, you know, people are all test tube babies. And what happens is the characters at one point go off, you know, to this location where these, you know, savages all exist. These people who, oh my gosh, they still have family and they still have, you know, the rudiments of a culture long lost to this modernity and this new kind of citizenry, a new way of living for the modern human. And, you know, I remember reading the book and thinking it was interesting, but now, you know, having grown up, I mean, because I read it back in school, now I look at the world and I think about people saying, you know, the kids don't go out and, you know, they don't go out on dates anymore, guys and girls. The kids all go out together in groups, you know, and we see, especially in Japan, we've talked about this, the reports in Japan of more and more platonic relationships. And I mean, I definitely think that in some ways technology and culture are obviously influencing the way that human relations have occurred traditionally. And in fact, what we're also seeing is that new traditions are actually forming. I don't know that it's, I mean, we could look all the way back to ancient Rome and we could say, look at what people did and how they interacted then. Look at how people interacted in the, you know, United States in the 1950s versus the 1960s. The much more conservative kind of minded, you know, hey, you know, Billy Sue, you want to go out on a date on Friday night and everything, go get a milkshake, you know, versus in the 1960s, free love, everybody's doing, you know, what feels good, you know, sexual liberation, all that. I mean, you see various trends and you see different things as time goes. And many would say that if anything, today seems to actually more closely mirror almost what it was like in terms of young people and their relationships in the 1950s rather than the 1960s and 70s with the free love and promiscuity and things like that. So I don't know. It's almost like a pendulum swinging. And yet in some ways, though, I do see when you pair that with technology, I do see some certain similarities to what Huxley had been talking about. But one of these novels that everybody's talking about in terms of how it predicted things that would be occurring in the future, you couldn't have this discussion and not talk about 1984 George Orwell.
But they're all talking about it wrong, aren't they?
Well, I think
a lot of people are.
I just think it's really prone to, you know, your political position and things like this. I would just say this. News speak is a real thing.
Yes.
As Orwell talked about. The problem I see is that we see people in the press saying that, you know, the current administration is doing it. We have the current administration saying that the press are the ones doing it. I think that if you want to use that term that many have used today, alt facts, I think alt facts in their truest essence are truths that are presented with a very, very obvious bias or ideology in such a way that the truths present information with a spin that may not be entirely true or unbiased, but there are truths nonetheless, just with an incredible, you know, bias attached to them, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about this a lot on Middle Theory, and the idea that bias can take true information and can spin it in a way that someone will say, well, look, guys, these are facts. Facts are facts. Well, why do facts so often contradict one another? You know, now, having just said that, I'm sure that, you know, somebody would say, well, Micah is, you know, going off the deep end here with fake news himself, because facts are supposed to just be facts, right? Well, that's the whole thing. When an individual or an ideology or a movement that adopts a certain ideology and the individuals within said movement take truths and then they present that to the, you know, the public through media or through whatever else, through, you know, the internet, through any kind of media that is capable of reaching large amounts of people, and you present information with a particular bias, you know, that to me is an alt truth or an alt fact. I mean, it's very hard to get to a point where you are completely unbiased, and very few of us are. Let's just admit it. If you can get to a point where you're completely unbiased and you can really just look at truths without, you know, trying to tie up politics or your personal values or opinions or beliefs into it, you may be a robot. I don't know. I mean, it's very hard to do that. But that's part of the issue, is that everybody has their biases, opinions, and beliefs, and anyone who disagrees with someone wants to call what they disagree with the alt-truth or the alt-facts. Getting to the core, the real truth, is difficult, and that's why I so often, you know, it really advocate a sort of centrism as it relates not only to politics, but to a variety of things. And we discuss that a lot on this show too. But there are more overt elements, I think, that in 1984 emerged, like the surveillance state, Big Brother, those kind of things. You know, the Mashable article right here, it says, although the NSA, as the world now knows it, is not quite the extreme as Orwell's Big Brother, the use of surveillance, news jargon, and police helicopters are indeed all prophecies that occur in 1984.
Yeah.
And so many I'm seeing, and this is the funny thing, on Amazon they're saying that sales of that book have just skyrocketed.
And one of the things that I find really interesting about it, though, and not so much in regards to surveillance or anything like that, but as far as the prevalence of newspeak or alt facts and these kind of things in today's society, sometimes it's something that's perpetuated by the government, but a lot of times it's not. It is willingly and almost gleefully become part of our lives, and it's something the public lovingly embraces.
People embrace ideas that reflect what they already believe. You know, this kind of a confirmation bias. And so it's weird because the newspeak and the Big Brother that Orwell warned about, they were very much this idea of a kind of an authoritarian overreach of power by government, you know, and pushing this off on the populace. And strangely, people being rallied and embracing it. Whereas I think in truth, what we need to really worry about is allowing ourselves to become so ideological, rather, that we present the news speak ourselves and we buy into our own hype with or without Big Brother having to give it to us.
Yeah, exactly.
But when it comes to these, you know, fictitious representations of dystopian future or whatever else that seem to predict things before they happen, this is one that really, I mean, really blows my mind. And when we come back from this break, I'm going to share with you what may be, I think, the strangest instance where someone seemingly predicted elements of a future yet to come in a novel that they had written. I mean, some of the stuff you wouldn't necessarily call predictions. You would call it, I mean, expectations for what is most likely to come. But there are some instances where the information given by the fiction author goes a little further than that. When we come back, we'll look at one here on The Graylian Report. Stay with us. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, wrapping up this week's edition. Thanks always for joining us out there in Gradio Land. Matt, are you familiar with a novel that was called Stand on Zanzibar by John Bruner?
Vaguely.
It was written back in 1969. I had not heard about this until fairly recently, but it is described as being perhaps the most predictive novel ever. Okay. So what exactly did it predict? Well, Stand on Zanzibar, again, may be the most accurate depiction of the future ever contained in a single fiction book. It was set in the year 2010 in the U.S. The book sees the country under the administration of a president named Obomi, written in bits and fragments of the characters' lives in real time, public service announcements, obituaries, advertisements. Amidst a chaotic and dystopian society, terrorist threats and attacks are an everyday occurrence, and violence in schools is old news. Detroit, in his world, is akin to a ghost town. Bruner also makes a lot of positive predictions about life in the 21st century, though. He says the hookup culture and gay lifestyles are widely accepted in 2010 of his novel, and people have satellite TV, TiVo-type viewing, and electric cars in their homes. He even got a lot of things right on the good side as well as the bad. But, I mean, I think the one that really hit me was, I mean, the President Obomi. What an unusual
yeah,
name.
Yeah, right.
What an unusual name to pick for a president of the United States. And how incredibly similar, of course, to our former commander-in-chief, Mr. President Barack Obama. I mean, sometimes, again, they say truth is indeed stranger than fiction. Maybe we have observed a few instances of that tonight here on the program. But, hey, keep an open mind. Maybe one of you guys out there will be the next novelist to predict the future. I just hope the predictions that you make are of a future that is good, one that we can all look forward to. We look forward to the future every week here on this program as we continue forth in space and time together. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Racing Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Matthew and I, and of course all of you guys out there, we appreciate all that you do. Join us next week again from 6 to 8 p.m. as we continue our forays into the fringe on the Graylian Report. I remain, of course, your doctor here in the dark heart of the Hollow Earth. We will catch you next time. And until that time arrives, do stay strange out there.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.